our backgrounds were different, and Jim came into the marriage subconsciously thinking in terms of recreating what he had come from in his past. There was a very high value put on time, being on time for everything, and he was usually about 10 or 15 minutes early, which to me was a ghastly waste of time, you know. To ever be any place early was a waste of time. And I had come from a family that we were never on time for anything, and nobody took it too seriously. That's just the way life was. And so we came from very different backgrounds, and Jim came from a background of people in his life. His mother was a very strong personality. His teachers were, his coach was, and nobody tolerated anything. You just kind of snap to and salute and say, "Yes, sir." And you feel love because someone is giving you strong direction in your life. So when we came into marriage, he expected that of me. And I came from a background where love is not communicated in that way. Love is communicated with long-suffering, with patience, with looking the other way, or just wait till she gets over her mood and everything will be all right. Just ignore it. Everything is fine. And that's the way we operated in our family. And that was a threat to my husband, and he was a threat to me. And we had to learn to figure out each other what we had brought into our marriage and what God had in mind and how he could use these two very vastly different backgrounds and blend them together into something completely new, a new home, something that he wanted to do, a new thing in our lives. And so we had to learn to humble ourselves and to say, "I'm sorry, I was wrong." That was much harder for me. That was not so hard for Jim to learn to do that because he almost worshiped truth. And so if it's wrong, you say it and let's get on with life. To me, that was a very real threat. And for him to come down on me on something said to me he didn't love me. And to him it said, "I love you so much, that's why I'm telling you this." So you can just see the differences there. And I'm glad we were Christians. I'm not sure if the marriage would have lasted had we not been. And there were tears, and God did a lot of humbling and breaking in our lives. He's still doing some, but he did an awful lot, especially in the early years. And we had to review the fact that love was a commitment. You know, it's interesting, but there are a group of Indians in Mexico, and they're called the Soto Indians, S-O-W-T-O-W. And their word in their Indian language for love and obedience is the same word. Isn't that interesting? There's no difference in their minds. That if you love, you obey. And I thought of this in relationship to a verse in the Bible in the book of John that says, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." And you're probably wondering, what has this got to do with loving my husband? But I think what it's expressing is an attitude that if we really love another person, we are anxious to do what pleases that person. We're looking for ways to please that person. And we're not just thinking selfishly on what I want. And today I thought we would cover 7 ways that we can love our husband. Do you have... let me have you pass these out, if you will, so that you can follow as I'm talking. Okay, all right. Then you can follow along. The first of these 7 ways is acceptance. And that word means to receive favorably, to value, or to highly esteem. And if you receive another person, that means you take them like they are. Have you ever seen an ad where somebody is selling something and they put the words under the amount, "as is"? That strikes me kind of funny, but I really think that's what God wants us to do in our relationships, and especially the marriage relationship. I want you to love this man, and then in little words, "as is." And so often we think, well, we want to pray that God will love the person and we'll change him, but God says, no, it's the other way around. You love the person and I'll do the changing. And that's where we have to struggle, because we are so intent on wanting to, from the time we're married, pretty soon in the game, we're ready to change this person. We stand at the altar and we say, I do. And sometimes I think what we really mean is, I will redo. Mm-hmm. We've already seen little things that we think need working on, and we're going to see that that's taken care of. We need to imitate God's acceptance of us. In Romans 15:7, it says, accept one another as Christ has accepted you. You know, when you stop and think about that verse, that is really loaded. That is a loaded verse. When I think about how Christ has accepted me, and I think of all the flaws, and I think of the disobediences, and the times I've tried his patience, all the things I've done, you know, God has never gotten insecure. Isn't that wonderful? I don't make him insecure. He still loves me. His love doesn't waver. There is a steadiness there, a faithfulness there. And granted, we're not God, but we are trying to come to a place in our lives where we're letting Christ live his life through us, so we should begin to look more and more like Jesus Christ. Not that we're sufficient in ourselves to be that way, but it's a surrender. And we're asking Christ to live his life through us more every day so that we can look more like him. Then we're able to receive and accept other people like God accepts us. God wants us to be change agents, and it is so, the most normal thing is to think in terms of the other person's irritation and how that irritation is making us feel. And sometimes we don't stop to think that the very reason God put us with that mate is to allow that irritation to highlight something in our lives that we haven't been willing to look at. And so he puts that person with that obnoxious trait or that area of their life that's not under control in order to build character in our own lives in an area of weakness. And Jim and I, we have found this so often over the years that, for example, that Jim likes everything. He has this saying, a place for everything and everything in its place. And I'm kind of like Frank and Ernest, you know, the little motto on one of their desks says, my motto is a place for everything and everything all over the place. And I'm not quite that bad, but I've had to work on that over the years. And so my tendency toward being a little slipshod has pointed up in Jim's life an impatient spirit. And we've talked about this together. And so God has put his finger on that area in Jim's life. And Jim's desire for neatness and order has put a finger on my life in showing an antagonistic spirit, a little rebellious spirit there. That, well, I'm just me, you know, and he can just take me like I am. Well, there's a little attitude there of rebellion and unwillingness to change, and God has put his finger on that in my life. So, really, we're quite good for each other, and we've been learning a lot over the years. We've been married 27 years now, and it's getting better all the time. So, to receive favorably, to value, to highly esteem is what acceptance is. It's a feeling that my mate is basically very pleased with me and is willing to let me be what God created me to be. Now, we can say today, okay, that's the way I'd like my husband to feel. I wish he did feel that way. But right now, we're talking about us because our husbands aren't here and there's not a man here talking to them. But in our own lives, to just say, Lord, I'm going to leave him to you. I'll love, you change. But Lord, I want you to change me. And I'm asking you today to change me in the areas where I need it. And I want my husband to be basically very pleased with me. And I want to be willing to let my husband be what God created him to be. I don't want to always be picking at him and trying and thinking that I can't really be happy with him unless certain changes are made. I want to see the good that's there and enjoy what is there. to be a change agent starts with us. We can be the one. We don't have to wait for the other person to change. We can be the one to model what needs to be modeled. And then in turn, they can respond to us because of that example. I remember so clearly one Sunday morning, and this happened often on Sundays. I would be late in making us get to church. And Jim, you just almost see the temperature rising. And this happened every Sunday morning. By the time we got in the car and were pulling out of the driveway, everybody was tense. And I had done it again. I'd made us late because that was my pattern over the years. I had had years and years to work on it, and I developed it very well. And I remember one Sunday morning, we got in the car and pulled out and were on our way to church, and I was suddenly, and Jim was whistling. He whistled all the way to the church that day, some hymn. And I sat there and I thought, this is really strange. You know, he doesn't seem disturbed, and I'm making us late again. And he just seemed so relaxed. We got to church, went all the way through church, went back home afterwards, and as soon as I could, I called him aside and I said, honey, what's up? I mean, you didn't get upset with me this morning. I made us late for church, and you didn't get upset. And he'd given me sermon after sermon every Sunday morning, you know, on what I was doing and how I could organize myself to be out on time. None of it seemed to do any good. And that day, I'll never forget it, but he looked at me and just smiled, and he says, honey, I just decided that God wanted me to love you and that he would do any changing that he felt was necessary, and that's what I want to do. And do you know what that did to me? It had a very interesting effect. I stood there and I thought, by golly, I'll be on time next Sunday morning if it kills me. I mean, I just melted inside. He motivated me to change. He didn't demand me to change, but he just loved me and accepted me. And I was the first one in the car the next Sunday morning, and we got there on time, plenty of time, in fact, early. And there have been very few times that I've made us late since then. There have been some, but basically the problem's over. And the whole difference was in me feeling accepted by him as I was, and then God changing me on the inside. And this is something we can do for our husbands. We can decide to accept them as they are and let God do the changing, and we can love and we can pray. Another way to love our husband is in gratitude, expressing personal appreciation, saying thank you. Now, that's a very obvious thing. You know, you may think, well, how redundant. I've heard that so many times. But do we do it? How often do we say thank you? How often do I say to my husband, honey, I appreciate you bringing a paycheck home once a month or twice a month, however often it is. You know, you're providing for the family the way you do. I don't want to take it for granted, and I want you to know I'm really grateful to you for that. Some husbands never hear that. Never. And yet that's a good way of expressing gratitude to him. Not being presumptuous. It keeps us from presumption, thinking, well, that's just his job. And my job's doing dishes, and I don't get thanked for it either. But just to take the initiative and begin to ask God to show you ways that you can express gratitude to your husband for his leadership in the family. Do you know, it's an awesome thing to be the head of a family, to have that responsibility. I can remember after we had children and Jim had to do some traveling, when he'd be away on trips, I suddenly found myself thinking, oh, this is what it's like to have final responsibility. I wish he was home. I'm having to do all this myself. And I'm having to break up this fight, and I'm having to referee here. And it's awesome to have final responsibility, and we need to remember to thank him for these things that they do and not allow ourselves to think, oh, that's just his job. Because a person does a much better job when they sense gratitude, don't they? I do. If I sense somebody is grateful for something, then I'm all the more anxious to give it. This is a real strength with my husband, too. Giving dries up without it. You know, there's an interesting verse here I want to read to you. It's Deuteronomy 28:47-48. And it says, because you did not serve the Lord your God joyfully and gladly in the time of prosperity, therefore, in hunger and thirst, in nakedness and dire poverty, you will serve the enemies the Lord sends against you. He will put an iron yoke on your neck until he has destroyed you. That's really hard words, isn't it? But God is saying, because you're not grateful, you're not grateful for what I have given you, then you will suffer. It's kind of like Deuteronomy 48, 47 and 48. I remember one day my daughter came home from school, and this is such a funny little story, but it just stuck with me over the years, and it was on the subject of gratitude. And the teacher had told them the story of a little old lady that lived in a vinegar bottle. And all she did all day long was pace around and around this vinegar bottle, wringing her hands and saying, "'Tis a shame, 'tis a shame, 'tis a shame." And finally the good fairy came, and the good fairy waved her wand, and she put her in a nice little house. Then the lady was happy at first to be out of the vinegar bottle and in the house. But after about a week or so, she began pacing around and around the little house. It was too small for her. And she began to wring her hands and say, "'Tis a shame, 'tis a shame, 'tis a shame." And the fairy came again and waved her wand and put her into a beautiful big mansion. And at first she was delighted. She was thrilled. But you know, a few weeks went by, and again she was discontent and ungrateful. And she began to walk around and around that mansion, wringing her hands and saying, "'Tis a shame, 'tis a shame." And the good fairy appeared again and waved her wand and put her back in the vinegar bottle. And you know, it's been kind of a crazy little story, but it's been a good reminder to me over the years that of this very verse that I read you, you know, that if we're not grateful, then God has to send enemies in order to get our attention. He could do this in America. I don't think we realize all that God has given us here, and I don't think we're as grateful as we should be. But if we were to lose it all someday, we'd soon realize the value, wouldn't we, of what he's given us. In our marriages, sometimes all we see are the things that are not there in our husbands, and God says, "Well, do I have to remove this in order to get your attention, in order to show you what you've got? Do I have to remove that?" And I pray not. And then affirmation. Another way to love our husband is in the area of affirmation. Affirmation is different than acceptance, because acceptance is more nonverbal. It's more of an attitude that's communicated. And affirmation is more verbal. It's done more with words, although you can do it without words too. But it corresponds to praise. And just like if I walked up like I did a while ago when Gail walked in the room, and I said hello to her, and then I said, "Gail, I love your outfit. I do. I think it's beautiful." That's affirmation. If someone walks up to you and compliment you on the way you do something or something about you, that's affirming, isn't it? That's called affirmation. And I want to read a verse here in Philemon, this tiny little one-page book. Verses 5 and 7. This is a good example of affirmation. Paul is saying to Philemon, his friend Philemon, "Because I hear about your faith in the Lord Jesus and your love for all the saints, period, your love has given me great joy and encouragement, because you, brother, have refreshed the hearts of the saints." See, he's affirming Philemon. He's telling him what he does right and well. And that's what affirmation is. It's telling another person what they do right and what they do well, something good about themselves. You could say to your husband, "I love the way you listen when I talk to you." If he does. If he doesn't, you can't say that. But that's an example. Or the way you give me eye contact when I talk to you. Have you ever talked to someone, and as you're talking to them, they're looking off here, and then they come back, and then they're like that, and you just think, they haven't heard a word I've said. And it's not very affirming, is it? But if you really want to affirm someone, when you talk to them, give them eye contact. Listen to what they're saying carefully so that they know you're interested in them. And this is something that we can do with our husbands. When they talk, don't always have to be doing something, yes, dear. Mm-hmm, yeah. Moving about the kitchen. And it often is. You know, the newspaper goes up and they turn their uh-huh on, and you're not getting that from them, and that's frustrating. So we know how it feels. Since we know how it feels, we may not be able to change the other person, although I think we can make suggestions if they're made in the right spirit. You know, honey, it would mean so much to me if when I talk and smile as you say it, if you just lay your paper down and look at me. You know, I just would love to have your eye contact. And then to just say it, not in a defensive way, but in a warm, loving way. And that even if the other person doesn't give it to us, it's something that we can do for them. And maybe in our initiating it, it will make the other person, it will be a model to them, and they'll find themselves responding in return. It's that idea, again, that we talked about of being a change agent. Not waiting for the other person to change, but us going ahead and being the one to change things. You know, I read a magazine some years ago, and it was the American Institute of Family Relationships. And in that magazine, it gave some statistics that I will never forget. It said, in the average American home, there are 10 criticisms made for every one affirmation. I thought, oh, that's staggering, 10 to 1. Every time in the average American family someone has something to say to one of the other persons, it is in the form of a command or a criticism. You know, I told you to pick up your socks, and why don't you do this, and you never do that, and so forth. 10 for every one affirmative statement. And they went on to say that it takes 4 affirmative statements to offset every one negative statement. Now that's interesting, isn't it? That once the damage is done, you got to work 4 times as hard to retake the ground that you've lost. And that's true. Yeah, that is true. But it's kind of like a garden. You know, the bend of nature is toward the wild, not toward the fruitful field. And all you have to do for your garden to go to the weeds is what? Ignore it. Just nothing. Absolutely nothing. But in order for that to be a well-weeded garden and a fruitful garden, you have to work hard, don't you? You've got to get out there and pull weeds. So, affirmation. I heard someone say one time that when you listen to someone carefully, you affirm them. And the art of listening means to listen patiently, intently, and with concern. And I think those are 3 good things to remember: to listen patiently, suppressing your ego, because the ego wants to get your word in, but just to suppress that ego, to listen patiently, intently, and with concern. And then consideration. And a good definition for consideration is it's the continuous and careful thought regarding the rights and feelings of others. Continuous and careful thought regarding the rights and feelings of others. Now that sounds like a little bit of work, doesn't it? If it's continuous and if it's careful, that means you've got to think seriously about it. How you can be considerate of someone else. Putting yourself in that person's shoes. How would I feel if I were him? And if I were him and the statement had just been made to him, how would that hit me? How would I feel? And learning to feel in the other person's situation. Jesus was so considerate of the disciples. He washed their feet. And that was something that only servants did in those days, certainly not a teacher, and certainly not Jesus Christ, heavens. But he got down, he got the basin and the towel, and he washed their feet. And Peter was rather insulted at first that he would do that, and Jesus said, it's necessary for me to set this example for you, because I in turn want you to do this for others. And if you see me do it, then maybe you'll be willing to take the role of a servant and do that too. I want to read you something that is short. It's a little story, and it's real short, but it is such a good description of what consideration really is. And I got this in Guidepost magazine. And a man is writing this story. Mr. Anderson is his name. He says, "I made a vow to myself on the drive down to the vacation beach cottage. For 2 weeks, I would try to be a loving husband and father, totally loving, no ifs, ands, or buts." See, he's going to be considerate. "The idea had come to me as I listened to a commentator on my car's tape player. He was quoting a biblical passage about husbands being thoughtful of their wives. Then he went on to say that love is an act of will. A person can choose to love. To myself, I had to admit that I had been a selfish husband, that our love had been dulled by my own insensitivity, lack of consideration. In petty ways, really, chiding Evelyn for her tardiness, insisting on the TV channel that I wanted to watch, throwing out day-old newspapers that I knew Evelyn still wanted to read. Well, for 2 weeks, all that would change. And it did. Right from the moment I kissed Evelyn at the door and said, 'That yellow sweater looks great on you.'" Oh, there's affirmation, isn't it? "Oh, Tom, you noticed," she said, surprised and pleased, maybe a little perplexed. "After the long drive, I wanted to sit and read. Evelyn suggested a walk on the beach. I started to refuse, but then I thought, Evelyn's been alone here with the kids all week, and now she wants to be alone with me." See how he's adjusting his thinking there to be unselfish. "We walked on the beach while the children flew their kites. And so it went. 2 weeks of not calling the Wall Street investment firm where I am a director." He really had to restrain himself there. "A visit to the Shell Museum, though I usually hate museums. And I enjoyed it. Holding my tongue while Evelyn's getting ready made us late for a dinner date. Relaxed and happy, that's how the whole vacation passed. I made a new vow to keep on remembering to choose love. There was one thing that went wrong with my experiment, however. Evelyn and I still laugh about it today. On the last night at our cottage, preparing for bed, Evelyn stared at me with the saddest expression. 'What's the matter?' I asked her. 'Tom,' she said, in a voice filled with distress, 'do you know something I don't?' 'What do you mean?' 'Well, that checkup I had several weeks ago, our doctor, did he tell you something about me? Tom, you've been so good to me. Am I dying?'" It took a moment for it all to sink in, and then I burst out laughing. "No, honey," I said, wrapping her in my arms. "You're not dying. I'm just starting to live." I thought that was neat. Just starting to live. Okay, and then another way to love our husbands is communication. That's a big one. We're only kind of touching the mountaintops here today because we just don't have time, and these are all loaded subjects, but we're just going to do the best we can. Let me give you a definition of communication that might help. It is that verbal and nonverbal means by which two people express their ideas and feelings to one another honestly and in a responsible way. And I think isn't that written in your handouts? Mm-hmm. But let's just think about that for a minute. It's the verbal and nonverbal means by which two people express their ideas and feelings to one another. It can be said with words. It can be said by a look on the face. It can be said by the way we put a book down, if we do it like that, or if we do it like that. That's nonverbal communication, and it gets the point across, doesn't it? I'm angry with you. People express their ideas and feelings to one another honestly and in a responsible way, with a willingness to say what the real problem is, not dishonest about it, how you really feel, not camouflaging it, and in a responsible way, not throwing things or having temper tantrums and putting pressure on the other person, but in a responsible way, being willing to sit down and talk something through. I think that often we run into problems when our goals are wrong. If my goal is to be ministered unto, and my husband changes a plan or does something that means I don't get what I want in a certain situation, then I can become very threatened. That's a wrong goal. That should have been a desire, but not a goal for me. And I can remember so many things in our early marriage that God just had to bring to my attention along this line. I can remember when we would go to a restaurant, that if my milkshake wasn't super thick and my steak wasn't medium rare, it just ruined the evening for me. I mean, that's kind of dumb, but that's where I was. And I had a certain goal, and it was not a right goal. So I would take it out on my husband, or whoever was around would notice my mood. I had a wrong goal. And but if our goals are wrong, if we're wanting to be ministered unto instead of ministering to the other person, then maybe we just need to admit that and just to say, honey, I was more interested in getting what I wanted than doing something for you, and I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? It's interesting. I've had a lot to learn about communication over the years. And I used to do a lot of hiding, a lot of defending of myself. And I finally one day told my husband, I said, you know, I don't want to become an elderly lady and be in the same pattern. I've done this long enough. Is there any way out of this trap and this little habit that I've built into my life? And he said, yeah, there is. He said, if every time you find yourself doing that, if you'll be honest about it, if you'll just communicate that honestly to God and to whoever's involved, just call it what it is. Don't say I was late because of the traffic lights. Just say, honey, I was late because I was having such a good time, I didn't want to leave. And I began to work on that in my life, and it's amazing the freedom God gave me once I began to communicate honestly in that area of my life that had been such a problem. Well, love cannot grow without communication. There has to be a getting of things out in the open in a responsible way and working on them. I have something I don't have time to go over here, but it is some excellent pointers on communication and conflict resolving that if you want to see it afterwards, I'll show it to you, but I don't think we have time right now. And then another way to love our husbands is in the area, and you knew this had come, didn't you? Physical affection. But this is very important. We're talking about anything from touch to complete physical union. And to realize that it is holy, it's not only that, but it's actually a command. It's not an option, it's a command. God in 1 Corinthians 7 says that we are to have sexual relations in marriage except for the purpose of prayer and fasting. So it's not like it's something subject to moods and whims, but God knows that our husbands have this need probably more than we do in most cases. And there are times where we don't always feel like responding. Jim and I try to work together on this. There are times where I feel he has a need, and he'll say, yeah, I do, but you're so tired and you've had such a heavy day, let's just wait. And that's helpful if you can do it that way. But sometimes we just, in marriage, there are times where we just have to be willing, like you were saying, to sacrifice. And to be willing to give of ourselves and not to develop selfish habits, but unselfish ones. And I think that developing a positive mental attitude in the area of physical affection is so, so very important. Because there just are times when we just couldn't care less, aren't there? We just want to be selfish. We just feel like being selfish. And just to work at building the marriage and not building in the wrong patterns there. One thing that helps me when I know my mental attitude isn't right is to immediately look to see if there's any unconfessed resentment in my life. Is there something that my husband did that I reacted to inwardly, and then I let that just stew inside? Is there something I need to get out in the open with him and with God? Confess resentment. And then another thing I think is to, in having a positive mental attitude, is to analyze any fear in our lives. If there's a fear of intimacy, and it can be something that goes way back to your youth. I had a couple of situations when I was a young girl, and where I was molested, and then years later, when I got married, I didn't realize that still the effect of that was there. And there was a fear of intimacy. I didn't want to be vulnerable. And thank God I had a husband I could talk this over with, and we worked through it together. But that can be a very terrifying problem. That can be very real to the person who's grappling with that. Just a fear of intimacy. And it may be that there's a need for counsel. I needed counsel in that. I had a husband who was able to help me, but not everybody. You know, my husband is a counselor and has been for 17 years, so I had that advantage. But it's something that we should get analyzed, get taken care of. And then another thing in working for a positive mental attitude is to make yourself attractive. Don't let yourself get run down over the years. Don't let yourself become unattractive for your husband, because their respect for you will become shaky if you do. And you want to keep up that respect because it's so basic to marriage. It's so important. And then understanding the differences between you and your husband. That men are more logical, women are more emotional. We just are. That's the way it is. There are exceptions to that, but generally speaking, that's true. And our approaches to things are different. We need to understand each other. Another thing that I like to stress, because I've seen it work in our own marriage and it has helped so much, and that is to pray together. Now, my husband was the one who really promoted this in our marriage. In fact, I found myself thinking at times, oh, he just has to pray about everything. But I found myself, after I got in the habit of doing this with him, just spontaneous, maybe 15-second prayer, maybe a minute or two, maybe as we were driving to someone's house for a meal, just to pray in the car. But I found this more and more becoming a part of my life, and I found it helping me. And I found that it was drawing us closer together, too, to pray together. I don't know if you've heard Billy Graham give the statistics that in Christian families, for a husband and wife that go to church together regularly, there's only one divorce in 40. And where they pray and are in God's Word together regularly, it's 1 in 400. So it gives you kind of an idea of the difference that it can make to develop that spiritual intimacy too, as well as in other ways. And then number 7 is adaptation. And adaptation means to fit in, to harmonize, to alter something so that it will meet a need. Now, I like that definition. I'm not sure exactly where I got that. I've had it around for a while, but it is the opposite of a demanding and self-centered spirit, a defensiveness to where somebody's going to take something away from me, so I have to protect it. But it's a willingness to adapt to someone else, to be willing to change your own plans, to be flexible. I know a wife that, back where I'm from, her husband made the statement to my husband one day. He said, my wife just thinks in terms of two things in our marriage relationship, and that's power and control. And I thought, how sad. She wanted to control the relationship. She was going to hold the trump card. She had the power of veto. Any ideas he had, any thoughts he had, if she liked it, fine, but she held the power of veto. And it might be good to ask ourselves in our lives, what do we do about this? What is our attitude? in our marriages. My husband said that to me one day. He says, you know, this was, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I guess. And he says, you know something? He said, the problem is that you hold the power of veto in our marriage. And boy, that hit me hard. I thought, oh, Lord, help. It was really a shocker. And I had to analyze myself. I had to analyze my attitudes and how I was coming across. And you know, I knew he was right. And I had to pray about that and ask God to make some changes in my attitude. And I had to work on it too. I heard someone say one time that the Christian life, the three most important things in the Christian life is humility, number two, humility, and number three, humility. It's the hardest thing in the world to work on, that word humility. Humbling ourselves, letting God fight our battles for us instead of us insisting on fighting Him. I want to mention here just a few of the how-tos, just to give you something to think about. In adaptation, how can we adapt ourselves to our husband? How can we show our love to him by adapting to him? And I just want to mention a few quick things here. First one is to dedicate myself to my husband physically, spiritually, and emotionally. As to the Lord. And the reason I say as to the Lord is because in Ephesians 5, 22 to 24, it says, wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. Be under their authority. Adapt to them. Now we think, well, I can adapt to the Lord, but I certainly don't intend to adapt to that man the way he is to me. And God says, I'm holding that man is the head of the family, and you're to adapt to him as, if you don't adapt to him, then you're really not adapting to me. That's the way it goes. It goes like that. God to husband, and then husband to wife. So to dedicate ourselves to that, be willing to make that decision that we will do that, God being our helper. And then, number two, plan your schedule in consultation with him. Don't make unilateral decisions. Now, there are decisions I make that I never have to ask Jim about, but there are others that I know I need to ask him about. And I can remember one time years ago that we were very, very short of money at the time. And it was just one of those times in our life where we just didn't always know where the next day or week's meal was coming from. And I remember some money came in the mail, and I was needing a hairbrush. And so I opened the envelope, and here was this money in the envelope. And I thought, boy, I need that hairbrush. And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, I should ask Jim first. And then I thought, yeah, but if I ask him, he might have something else in mind that we should do with this money. And so I ran across the street to the drugstore, and I bought a hairbrush, and I ran home, and I brushed my hair real quick so I couldn't take it back. Isn't that nice? I used it so I couldn't take it back. And then later I told him about the money. And you know, the next day, there was a knock on my door. And I went to the door, and it was a girl I knew. And I had helped her through her beauty academy. What do they call that, where they have to have someone sit for them while they demonstrate on their hair. And I had done that for her. And she was so grateful. She said, I have a little gift here, just a thank you gift. You can open it later. So after she left, I opened it, and I don't have to tell you what was in there, do I? It was a hairbrush, and it was just like the one I'd bought. And I couldn't take it back. I didn't know where she'd bought it. There was no receipt or anything. And I thought, you know, Lord, I think I get the point. I think I know what you're trying to say to me. And it was just that spirit in me that God was trying to bring under control. And then number three, present your ideas lovingly and humbly. Don't nag or push. And there have been a few times when I have presented my ideas and Jim has felt differently about something. And sure enough, it'll turn out like I said later. And what is the temptation then when you end up being the one right? You can hardly stand not to say it, can you? Boy, you just have to bite your tongue off. And this happened to us one time. We said Jim had bought a racing car set for our little boy, Jimmy. And I thought, he's not ready for that. You know, he'll just break it and it'll go on the shelf and that'll be it. And I mentioned that to Jim, and I brought it up a couple of times, and he kept saying, no, I think he's ready for it. I want to give it to him this Christmas. So he did, and everything I thought happened kept getting broken, and finally it went in the box on the shelf, and that was it. And about 2 months went by, and all this time I was just thinking, oh, I told him so. And I just kept saying, Lord, don't let me say it. Don't let me say it. And I didn't. And after about 2 months, Jim came to me one day and he said, you know that racing car set that we bought for Jimmy? And I said, yes. And he said, I want to thank you for not saying I told you so. And I thought, thanks, Lord. Because there were times I almost said that. And I was glad that I hadn't. And it built a respect at that moment into Jim for me, a little deeper respect. And that's valuable in marriage. That's what we want. And then number four, present your complaints with respect. Self-control. You may have to cool down first. There have been times where I've had to just go to the bedroom, get on my knees and say, Lord, I am as mad as hops at him. I don't want to tell him off. And Lord, just settle me down and just help me see this from your perspective. How do you want me to behave? Help me to believe that you'll take care of me in this if I just trust his leadership. And help me not to panic. And then just to let God cool you down. And then to go to the person and to present your complaints. But then you can do it with self-control. You can say things like, honey, when you do such and such, here's how it makes me feel. And I just want you to know, you know, I want us to be able to talk about these things instead of going in with your war axe. Then number five, ask advice on hard problems and decisions. Be teachable. Sometimes it's hard to do that, to be teachable. But to be willing to put yourself in that position, to learn from your husband. Don't make him feel that you have everything all figured out and you already know what you're going to do. He can feel very unneeded and very unwanted if we do that with our husbands. So get in the habit, not on everything, but you know where you need to. There's a little inner barometer in here that if we're sensitive, it'll tell us when we need to. And then never go against his will unless it clearly contradicts Scripture. And I feel that that's important. Now, in Acts 4:19, to me, is a very good balance on this point, because I could foresee a person being in a situation where maybe a non-Christian husband or even a disobedient Christian husband would ask the person to do something that they felt they couldn't do. And Acts 4:19 says, it's the apostles talking when they were told by the authorities in a certain city that they were to stop preaching in the name of Christ. And they said, whether it is right to listen to God or you judge. But we must do what God has told us to do. So in that case, there was a higher authority that the husband was in conflict with. And when that happens, then that is our only time that we can go around our husbands to a higher authority, that authority being God. And you have to get down to actual cases. Sometimes we make cases out of something that isn't really that important. We major on the minors and minor on the majors, and I'm not talking about that. But I'm saying in clear-cut cases where that may be needed, that it's conceivable that we might have to do that. Okay, now on your handouts, on the second page, down about the middle, it says Prayer of Acceptance. And here, I'm going to just read through this and then just give you a minute to think about this. And then don't sign this. Don't date it and sign it unless you really mean this in your heart. God says it is better not to vow than to vow and not keep your vow. And he will help you. You're not just doing it in your own strength. God will help you if you want his help. But I just want to stress the importance of when you sign something like this, of really taking it seriously. Lord, I accept my husband with his strengths and weaknesses as exactly the one you planned for me. Forgive me for being critical of him and causing him to feel at times rejected. I will pray each day over the 7 ways I can love my husband until I sense he is enjoying my acceptance of him. I realize I cannot do this in my own strength, but must rely upon the power of your Holy Spirit. So let me just give you a couple of minutes now to think about this and to pray. And if you don't want to sign it now, you feel like you can't now, then you might be able to sign it later, then fine. That's between you and God, and it's none of my business. But I just want you to take a minute or two now just to think about this.